Welcome to Let's Talk FCA, presented by Kroll & Morgan. We are your co-host, Mona Lombardo and Jason Crawford, bringing you the latest developments with the False Claims Act.
Thanks, Jason. Today we're joined by special guest, Tully McLaughlin. Tully is a partner in the Government Contracts Group, and he's co-chair of our False Claims Act practice. He's successfully litigated False Claims Act cases through trial and appeal, including cases brought by QTAM relators and the Department of Justice.
Today's topic is False Claims Act trials, and we invited Tully as a guest because of his extensive experience trying FCA cases to juries. And the depth of Tully's experience is unique in that most FCA cases are resolved before trial. In the last few years, more than 700 new cases were filed per year. Yet in a given year, there are only a handful of cases that make it all the way to a jury verdict. Tully, why do you think it is that such a small percentage of FCA cases go to trial?
Well, Jason, I think there's a few reasons. One is that many cases are dismissed early on, and sometimes that happens when a QTAM relator or whistleblower voluntarily dismisses their case upon learning that the government is not going to intervene in and take over the matter, and they're not willing to take it forward themselves, or because a defendant has been successful in a motion to dismiss. Others might make it to summary judgment, but no further. But beyond that, a lot of cases are ones that you will never see go to trial because there's some kind of resolution reached, a settlement of some sort. And the reason for that is that the False Claims Act has a treble damages framework along with penalties provisions. And that sets up a huge club that defendants are faced with when they are looking at the potential of trial and a judgment against them. And so settlement is always going to be an important consideration. That being said, I think you see a fair amount of settlements that are for low millions of dollars. And while that might seem like a lot of money in the context of the False Claims Act and its damages provisions, that may be a drop in the bucket compared to what a defendant might be facing if they were to go all the way through trial and be unsuccessful.
So, Tully, on a prior episode, we had Mark Troiana as a guest on the podcast, and he joked that while we think these cases are fascinating, they can be fairly technical and somewhat boring in the eyes of a juror. So tell us, how have you prepared your cases for trial so that your defenses tell a story that resonates with jurors?
Well, Mark was right and he was wrong, because he must not have ever been to my trials. They were extremely exciting all the way through, particularly the parts that where we were presenting our defense. But no, it's true. There are challenges in FCA cases with making them presentable to the jury. And, you know, in the first instance, it's the government or the relator who has the burden to prove their case, and they're going to go first. And so I think that those considerations weigh just as heavily, if not more so, on them. But for me, one of the most important things is making sure to present a clear theme or themes to the jury, and having that flow through each one of our examinations of witnesses during the trial. Now, your opening statement, of course, is your first opportunity to provide the jury with a preview of your story that you're going to present, your themes. And of course, you may not have a lot more opportunity until after the plaintiff closes their cases to come back to that. So it's important to really get a clear theme across to the jury, and one that tells a story that they can relate to.
So Tully, a few years ago, there was a case out of the Northern District of Alabama, the Acericare case, and it made headlines when the judge opted to bifurcate a trial into two phases, with the first phase focused on the issue of falsity, and the second phase focused on whether the company had knowingly submitted false claims. Why would a defendant want a bifurcated trial?
Well, I think a defendant would want it because the questions of falsity and knowledge, while they're ones that may seem distinct enough when you're briefing them or putting them in, on papers, it really is a lot blurrier at trial when documents and testimony are being presented. And bifurcation of those elements will help make clear to the jury long before they receive the instructions on the law that they're to apply, which of course is not until the end of the trial, that first you have to have a false claim before you even need to reach the question of whether the defendant acted with the required state of mind under the False Claims Act. So that's kind of an obvious reason why a defendant would like to have that. And of course, the other way to say that would be that you sort of get two shots at showing the jury why they're not liable.
Do you think other courts are likely to follow this precedent?
I'd have to say probably not. I think that the traditional bifurcation, such as between damages and liability, is something that is much more practical and acceptable. But bifurcating the liability elements, while I certainly am not opposed to it, I don't think it's going to be something we're going to see in a lot of other courts.
Let's switch gears a bit to discuss pretrial strategies. We defended an FCA trial here in LA where we were able to exclude testimony of one of the relator's key witnesses based on the grounds that it was not based on personal knowledge and overly prejudicial. The witness shared the relator's, shall we say, disgruntled view about the government contract at issue, and it was quite favorable to our defense to be able to preclude his disparaging, albeit baseless, perspective. In your cases, Tully, what sort of evidentiary fights occurred before trial, and how important were motions in limine to keep certain evidence from the jury?
Yes, Mona, all kinds of fights before trial, and motions in limine were a big one. Other pretrial briefing, all of those things are just critical to the conduct of the trial and certainly to its outcome. You know, some of the pretrial issues that I typically deal with are ones that include objections to witnesses, objections to evidence, things of that nature. And of course, if you can resolve some of those before you get into the courtroom, you're going to cut down on the time for the trial and the resources for the court, the parties, and of course that jury. But I would say that motions in limine are perhaps some of the most critical pretrial issues that come up. And in each of the False Claims Act cases that I've tried, there were some 10 to 15 motion limines filed between the parties. And I actually was looking back at some of them, and I can say that nearly all of them had a material impact on the trial and its outcome. You know, getting rulings on evidence that should or should not be allowed in at the trial, especially when you're in front of a jury, is so important. You know, think of it this way. Would you rather that the jury hear something objectionable and you object to it, and then the judge grants your objection, sustains your objection, and orders the jury to disregard? Or would you just rather that they never hear that objectionable evidence in the first place? I'd go with the latter approach.
Tully, were there any specific MILs from your past trials that you thought were particularly impactful that you can share with us?
Sure. And I guess I'll say first that, you know, there's some that you can kind of expect in any run-of-the-mill FCA case. So for instance, if the government has intervened, whether it's the government or a relator, they're going to file a motion in limine to exclude any evidence or argument about the fact that there's treble damages and penalties available under the False Claims Act. And if you're dealing with a relator where the government has not intervened, they're going to likely file a motion in limine to exclude any argument about the fact that the government is not there and what that does or does not mean. On the defense side, things that typically we would file, regardless of the issues at trial, is to exclude appeals to what we think of as the pecuniary interests of the jury, that, you know, they're taxpayers and that we're talking about taxpayer funds here. So that shouldn't come in. It shouldn't be an emotion-filled decision that they're making. It should be one based on the facts presented to them that are relevant. Another one would concern profit. Motive is not required under the False Claims Act, and we typically would try to exclude any evidence or argument related to the profit that might be gained off of the alleged false claims. But, you know, turning back to the importance of these, while those ones can be important, each particular case has its own special issues. And in one of my recent ones, there were a number of motions in limine that really impacted how the case was presented. For instance, the government in one of my recent cases filed a motion in limine to exclude evidence regarding commissions that the agency at issue had paid. And the question in the case was whether or not commissions being paid by the defendant were quote unquote regular or not within their industry. And the government didn't want any evidence about commissions that the agency was paying in a separate industry to be introduced. And they filed a motion in limine on that basis. We recognized that we were going to have an uphill battle with that motion. And so while we opposed it, we also put in something of an alternative for the judge to preview where this might come up at trial. And our alternative was that if the government opens the door on evidence regarding other commissions outside of the defendant's industry, that we should be allowed to bring in the evidence that the government agency was paying extremely high commissions in its own industry. And wouldn't you know it, that door was open during trial. We were able to bring in that evidence, and it ended up being something that was cited by the Court of Appeals in finding no liability in our favor on appeal.
So, Tully, you're referring to the D.C. Circuit's opinion in U.S. Ex Rel Purcell versus MWI?
Yes, that's the one.
And am I right that Judge Kavanaugh was on that panel?
Yes, he was.
He's certainly been in the news a lot this week as the president's nominee to the Supreme Court. Do you think he's going to get grilled by the Senate Judiciary Committee on that case?
Well, Jason, I think that the Senate Judiciary Committee might have some other opinions that they'd be more interested in of his. And of course, he didn't write this opinion. It was authored by Judge Rogers. But the case does have some relevance to issues of Chevron deference, so you could see it come up.
So, Tully, as someone who's litigated against relators and the Department of Justice, what are the difference between cases where it's the relator standing up before the jury and cases where it's the United States of America presenting their case?
Well, right there is the difference, is who's bringing this case. And while in my experience where the government is not in the courtroom litigating the matter, we've not been able to make light of that fact expressly, I do think that it has an impact on the jury. Just as if the government is the one who's bringing the case, I think it has an impact on the jury. When the Department of Justice is in the courtroom telling the jury that it has been defrauded, I think that that impacts the jury. And that's one of the reasons why when the government intervenes in a case, you typically less often will see those cases go to trial, because it will up the ante, so to speak, for a defendant to look at settlement.
So this final question is for both Tully and Mana. If you had to share with the audience one of the lessons you learned from your FCA trials, what would it be?
Well, let me jump in here. I would say as an FCA defense attorney, any circumstance where a government witness testifies in favor of the defendant contractor is going to be beneficial for my client. So we had a trial where the relator alleged fraud in the inducement of the contract, claiming that our client had submitted knowingly false contract cost estimates in a bid for a contract to update the nation's space launch software for the Air Force. Part of relator's supposed proof that the original estimates were false was that by contract closeout, the contract value had more than doubled from the original estimate. And we put on as our witness one of the Air Force program managers who had worked closely with our client's employees over the course of the contract. And he testified not only as to the many contract modifications the Air Force issued, which changed the scope of contract requirements, accounting for the increased cost over time, but he also described the positive and mutually respectful relationship between him and other Air Force employees and our client's employees who were jointly working on the project with the Air Force folks. He also explicitly testified that he didn't believe our client had done anything fraudulent. So ultimately, in an FCA case where the relator is supposedly standing in the shoes of the government, as Tully's alluding to, it's quite powerful to have the government folks testify on the side of the defendant contractor. And going back to our earlier question, this particular testimony was definitely not boring, but pretty enlightening for the jury to see the Air Force person testifying on behalf of the defendant.
I would echo what Mana said, that anytime that you can get the government testifying on your behalf, it is going to be a good thing. And of course, in the wake of Escobar, it might be reason enough that you never make it to trial. But I know Mana's case was a few years before that, as was one of mine, in which we were able to present the contracting officer in a matter where there was alleged fraud by a security contractor who was protecting the State Department officials overseas in the Middle East. And the contracting officer testified not only that he didn't think that our client had done anything wrong, but that he was happy with their performance and that he was still working with them at the time of the trial. And that, of course, was very effective testimony. The other things that I would just add are, it seems like an obvious statement, but be prepared. Every day you have to be prepared, and that really means expecting the unexpected. So you've just got to go over your materials, even if you've gone over them 100 times. Be ready the next day. Who are my witnesses, and what am I expecting? What might the other side's witnesses say that I haven't prepared for quite yet? And last, you have to roll with the punches. You know, there's a lot of rulings that will happen very quickly during the course of a trial. And for instance, you'll get rulings on objections to questions. And you may disagree with those rulings, but there might also be opportunity in them. I've had a number of trials, actually, not just in the FCA context, where I felt that the judge was improperly allowing hearsay testimony. But while I would still object on those types of questions, when it came time for my witnesses to be presented, I used the scope of the judge's rulings on hearsay to my advantage and to bring in some hearsay where I thought it was helpful to our case. And so if you can do that, you're going to have a much better chance of success in your trials, being prepared and expecting the unexpected, rolling with the punches.
Well, thank you again, Tully, for joining us today and sharing all your thoughts on FCA trials. That's it for today's episode. If listeners have any questions about what we discussed today, I can be reached at 213-443-5563. Jason can be reached at 202-624-2562. And Tully can be reached at 202-624-2628. We'll see you again next time on Let's Talk FCA.
Let's Talk FCA is brought to you by Kroll & Mooring LLP. You can find more information at kroll.com/podcasts.